What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Welcome to the Katie Halper Show. You can hear the Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI, that's 99.5 FM, or WBAI.org. You can also find us on SoundCloud and iTunes where you can rate and review us, and I sure hope you do. On today's episode, we speak to Michael Graham, who makes the racial justice case for free college tuition, and Natalie Shore, who makes the feminist case for single payer. Michael Graham is a senior writer for ProgressiveArmy.com, the managing editor and co-founder of the book publisher ActifyPress.com, and for Actify.press, a curated progressive news and commentary site. During this interview, Michael talks to me about two of his pieces, Insidious Comfort, Racism and Privilege Collide on the Left, and On Solidarity, Class, Race, and Progress. Make sure you check out the project he just launched at Actify Press called Resilient Solidarity, which is dedicated to building solidarity on the left. So let's see. Really excited. Michael works on all sorts of really great projects. Actify Press. And how many Actifies are there?
There are two. Other than the, you know, the social media spaces. But ActifyPress.com is where we have, we're a publishing organization. We have some books we publish over there at Actify.com. Some great writers. One of the things we believe in is transparency of language. And that's really big for us because often on the left, we like to use the big words and show off our credentials, and nobody can hear us because we're using language that nobody understands. So one of the things we like to do is one of the things that we stand for is assuring that the maximum amount of people can understand what's going on around them at any given time. So that.
So you actually care about accessibility and
absolutely.
And people being able to understand what you say as opposed to just showing off your turns of phrase.
Yeah, my turns of phrase and my Ivy League. I didn't go to Ivy League school. You know what I mean? I don't think we need to prove that we're intelligent. We know we need to get our message across. That's the most important thing. So that's what ActifyPress.com, that's what the publishing arm is all about. And Actify.press as our curated content blog. And we have a lot of great voices from the left being curated on that site, and we also have our own internal writers, sort of like Huffington Post, sort of like that. And those two things feed off one another. At least they will once we get going really well.
A vicious cycle.
Yeah, we
except
hope.
Except a good vicious cycle.
A good vicious.
And then Actify, what's that about?
Actify was, like I said, we published some books for some great writers. Mostly the first two books we did. The first book we did was my book, was a collection of essays about Bernie. And we brought in a few other people to do some writing. Pamela Goetz from over at Progressive Army, Beth Lynch, a few other people. If folks go on to ActifyPress.com and go buy all the books because that helps support what we do. And our news and of course our news and commentary blog where we curate a lot of different voices from across the left. But when we stood that website up, we said what we wanted to do was, anybody on the left in the left space, that has a voice or a platform, we want to have you here. There's going to be differences of opinion. There's going to be, different ideas, different views, but I think that's how we grow as an organization, as a movement. And I think there's way too much fracturing. There's way too many, sensitive feelings. There's a lot of stuff going on. It's really unnecessary. So what we decided was, you know, not everybody's going to get along with everybody, but hey, we're going to put these folks on the platform. And so if there's an issue, let's hash it out, right? Let's talk about it and see where we can go from there. We don't believe in censoring folks. You know, we believe that, okay, you have a platform. We're a curation site, and what you say, if it's within reasonable grounds, I don't have a problem with you. You know, as long as you're not running around talking about let's burn down the White House, I can't help you with that. There's no space not for that here.
Against,
there's a different situation, So again, we just want to get as many voices in one place as possible. And hope to foster some communication. I believe there's space for everyone. Most voices across the left, from anarchists on over to neoliberals and we'll call them Democrat lights, you know. So, sure. And we're all trying. Most of us, 90% of us are trying to get to the same space. So if we work together, even if we're not, you know, some will take a bus, some will take a train, some will run, some will walk, some will crawl there with no shoes. But as long as we're going in the same direction and work together whenever we have an opportunity, and when there is conflict, we come together and squash it and hopefully grow and learn from it. I think that's a much healthier environment. And everybody gets to say what they want to say. And if you don't agree, let's talk. If there's something you feel is unfair or insensitive, let's talk about it. You know, I'm not going to censor your stuff, and I don't expect anybody to censor anybody else's stuff. So, again, within reason. So, that's what we are as a platform. And we also decided to keep all the advertising space. So all the advertising space is ours. So, you know, when you go to the website, you'll see advertisements for our books. So it would kind of feeds into what we're trying to do.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of funny because how much is this site then supposed to be about debate and beef squashing? How much is it just diverse?
It's diverse, but the beef squashing part is coming soon. It's an idea from my wife called the Frenemies Forum. So we're gonna have somebody come in, and we're gonna have somebody, people from the right, come in and write a piece. And then we'll have a forum on the weekend, and folks will come. We'll talk about whatever this subject is. Okay, you come in, and I'm a staunch anarchist, and I think we should tear the whole machine down. Let's talk about why, and let's take that idea apart, and let's discuss it, and see if we can all learn from it. Mm. And that's one of the things we're trying to do with it.
Well, this is interesting because my friend over the weekend, he thought I should come up with some kind of project that was like a social media like summit, bringing people together, but not left and right, because more intra-left. I think the more troubling fighting is occurring.
Yeah, that's the more detrimental fighting to us. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. And we once this forum is stood up, we're hoping by the end of April we'll have it stood up, and where people can come in, and you know, sometimes it'll be just text, you know, you just type in what you think, and sometimes it'll be video, you know, where people can come in and discuss these ideas, and we kind of hash it out as folks from this specific Frenemies Forum. It could be anybody. If you've got an idea you want to write about, let's talk about it, right? But for the most part, it'll be ideas from the left, within the left space. And I think
I like that.
And I think that's more healthy than And I'm guilty of it too. I can be a bit toxic online as well. I've done my share of flame wars, and I'm not going to stop just so people know. I'm still going to do my thing, but there is a space for more progressive and more positive dialogue, and I think we can help with that.
So Michael, he wrote two really great pieces that are on the related themes of alliances and coalitions and working together. One of them is on solidarity, class, race, and progress. Mm-hmm. And the other one is insidious comfort.
Yeah.
And you wrote this one, Insidious Comfort, Racism and Privilege Collide on the Left. Can you tell us about what made you write this article?
Well, one of the strange things that popped up shortly after Bernie when loss was inflicted upon Bernie. heart-crushing defeat, one of the things that popped up was people were talking about working with the alt-right with this, you know, this set of nebulous aims, taking down, you know, ending war and taking down the mainstream media. And I'm like, huh, what? That doesn't make any sense. Working with people like Mike Cernovich. I'm an ideas guy. If you have an idea, I'm not going to fault you for that idea. I may agree, I may not agree, but, you know, it's an idea. Okay, that's garbage. We'll throw that one away. Sure. What I assumed was going to happen is that once people started saying, hey, this is a bad idea, I assumed that people would say, you know what, maybe it is a bad idea, right? And it just escalated from there. But then it started to expand because a lot of folks came in and started just... You know, it was really nasty what they were saying, what people were saying, right? And it became, you know, Cernovich is not a bad guy. He's not really all right. He's all right. You know, from a person of color, from a black, or especially from a DOS, the Descendant of Slaves point of view, there is no difference. You're in that space, right? You are actively seeking an ethno state, and that does not happen without war and calamity, right?
anyone seeking an ethno state, I mean, mm-hmm. Were they saying he's a nice guy? Because people were downplaying, they were saying he was alt-light, not alt-right.
Yeah, alt-right, yeah. And there's two things to that, right? Number one, that's the purpose of the alt-right, right? The movement is all about, for lack of a better term, whitewashing the neo-Nazi past, right? Guys get nice haircuts, put on a suit, same rhetoric, same goals, cover the tattoos, but it's the same stuff, right? You go
cover
get it,
the tattoos.
Cover the tattoos, and you get a job, you know, in the city or with the police or in government somewhere, and you push your agenda wherever you are. But when you start talking about bringing racists into spaces where it's mostly people of color, descendants of slaves, and anti-racist people, you're inviting an arsonist into your home, right? And I some people will say, yeah, but it's just, you know, this is not that serious. This is just, we're just going to work together to stop war, da 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 da. Okay, you do your thing, we'll do ours. We can do it at the same time, parallel paths. You do your thing, I'll do ours. We'll do ours, right? Because you have shown no intentions of helping us, right? At the end of the day, right? And additionally, you've never shown intentions of helping us. And additionally, when this fight is over, when the smoke clears, what's going to happen, right? Because you're well funded. Right, they've got billionaires backing them over there, right? And our billionaires and millionaires—they're not backing any of us, right?
Sure.
Right. So, there's a couple of people doing something. That's not enough, right? So when the smoke clears, and suppose we stop the mainstream media and wars are over, when the smoke clears, guess what? I've knocked out your enemies, right? And I've made you stronger. And you're better funded. What do you think is going to happen when the smoke clears, right?
Right.
So it's just to my mind, it was
another bad person.
Yeah, exactly.
Worst person.
Yeah, a worst person, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then all they're gonna do is turn that machine on us. That's all they're gonna do, right? And I don't believe that I don't think we were gonna get anywhere. At the end of the day, these people are our class enemies. For those of us on the left, you want to bring these folks to my house and tell me that it's okay to work with them, but I know who these people are. My parents grew up in the desegregated South. They know this, right? I live in the South now. I know this. I read history, right? I know who these people are, and they will tell you who they are. They will tell you that the outright was crafted to become the innocuous face of violent right movements, right?
Yeah.
They'll tell you that.
You said that they have the same rhetoric, but it's actually worse because they have a toned down.
Yeah, and a toned down version that kind of gets under your skin.
They're advocating the same thing. They don't use the N word or K word.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that's kike because people may not know that.
Yeah.
And I feel comfortable. One of the fringe benefits of being a Jew.
Yeah, there you go.
But they don't run around using those words, right? They are, as you said, they're covered.
They're meant to be seen reasonable. Right.
Yeah, they're reasonable. They're like bourgeois. They're not that very
exactly.
They're leaders, at least. Now, I'm not saying who they attract, which is a different issue.
And that's another issue. Yeah.
But the leaders are, they're not working class in their aesthetic or in their kind of signifiers, right?
That's what it's designed to do. That's what the alt-right is designed. That's what they were developed to do, is to make it seem innocuous, right? And they pull you in. And then they, the red pill, blue pill, then suddenly once they soften you up with the jokes and the camaraderie, then they hit you with, this is the real problem in America.
Right.
And they pick on people who feel, outcast. They find these people, and what they get is a diehard loyal soldier.
Yeah.
Right. Who will do anything for them. Right. And that's just the nature of the beast. So to my mind, I think number one, people were not clear on what the alt-right really is, and people weren't clear on the level of danger they are, especially to a left movement.
Yeah.
Because they're number one, there's not enough of them to make a difference electorally, right? They're not going to get
alt-right, you're
saying. The alt-right, yes. There's not enough of them to make a difference electorally, number one. And number two, they're not going to vote for an anti-war candidate. Right? That's not going to happen. Right? And again, there's not enough of them anyway, even if they did do that.
Right. There are some people who probably want to kill us off who also are against war in a very isolationist sense. Or at least they're against spending money on wars as they're fought today, because they think that, there should be like a race war. But what are we doing getting involved in the Middle East, and why are we dying for these people in the Middle East? So the other problem with this thing is that it's such a theoretical argument, right? I think what you can say and what you've been saying is that there just is no real case where it would work.
Yeah, no, like, there's no way for it to work. And
there's no way.
And that's part of that was part of the fight, was to make sure it couldn't work.
And I think that's the only, just on the like a purely intellectual level of discussion, philosophical one, the only thing is that, there are, I think that, and what makes it hard, and I think we should like do justice to the fact that it's hard, is that there are probably people who would go to a protest against certain wars, but then would ultimately want to go to war with us and kill us in a world war based on, ethno states.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's those guys would have maybe 0.03% of what was considered the right nowadays. And they may show up, but when they go in that voting booth, we can't depend on them for anything.
So I guess, and that goes into the calculus you're saying, like if we could depend on them for a certain thing,
the same reason why I don't want to work with them, I don't think we should work with them, is the same reason why we can't trust them in the voting booth, right? Because they're racist. what they're going to do in the voting booth, even if they in what you're talking about, even if they showed up for a anti-war rally, okay, great, good job, guys.
I don't know if does that mean working with. I guess the whole thing is like, I don't even know what that means.
I think it's an important discussion to have, whether we have it yelling or we have it, sitting down and over tea. It's a discuss. We need to be clear, and that's part of the reason why I wrote the article, Insidious Comfort, is that these folks, that particular camel gets its nose under the tent, we will be fractured overnight. We will be fractured overnight because we as black people, we sometimes have the habit of going at our allies a little harder than we need to. How long would it take for somebody to lean over into the other side and going about their business, right? Especially when, you know, our fights don't impact them, not in the short term anyway, right? So we have to, I think, we as black people need to be careful about how we treat people that have been positive allies, right? It's people that have a good track record and have proven to be good allies, you know, that if they make, you know, one mistake or even a couple of mistakes, you know, if I get an 80 on the test, I still pass, you know, but I miss a couple of questions, right? So I think we need to be careful about, not just black folks, people of color in general, and us as descendants of slaves. It's important that we cultivate these relationships. We can't say that, you don't understand our struggle and then get mad when people make mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. We can't have it both ways and then say we don't want to train white folks what to do,
right?
We can't have it both ways, right? If we want allies, we need to have conversations with them just like any other relationship. We need to cultivate that relationship, you know? And if we can do that better, and on our side, and we can, white folks are more patient about and willing to put their privilege on the line. And a lot of folks are coming out and doing that nowadays because of the way our economy is now. People are seeing our point of view better, right? Mm-hmm. They're seeing that poverty is inflicted upon a people. It's not an issue of not wanting to work hard. It's not an issue of your cognitive abilities. It's an issue of the economy is not structured to help you, right?
So you're saying people are learning the hard way.
People learn
the ideologies that they were sold.
Exactly. Some of them may or may not connect it to their vote for Ronald Reagan back in the day, but they know their current circumstances are just like they're just nearly just like the circumstances of the black people on the other side of the tracks. Now I am where they were, right?
Right.
You know, if we discuss wealth, that's something different. But at the bottom line is a lot of white folks are in a position they never thought they would be in. That's part of what's with the opioid epidemic. It's not just the availability of opioids. It's the fact that, that people are living miserable lives. They don't know where the next meal is going to come from. They're being evicted. There's all kinds of things going on across the country, not just in black and brown communities anymore. It's not as divided as it used to be. And these things are new to a lot of white folks. And these are people that follow the rules. You know, I got an education, got a job.
Sure.
You know, I did everything right. You know, I pay my taxes on time. And it still didn't work. I'm still living in a tent because...
Yeah, and it can go two ways, right? Mm-hmm. Then they can have the come to church moment, come to whatever.
Come to Jesus,
come to Jesus moment, thanks. Mm-hmm. Or they can be like, oh, actually, it's because of... They can like double down on the narrative and be like, well, it's actually because black people are taking handouts, so that's why...
Yeah, there's less money to go around.
So it can go either way. I mean, like with a lot of... kind of traumas or shocks to the system, people can go either way. So, I mean, which is why I think we need to fight for potential allies. So someone who, let's say, loses, like a white person who loses their job, let's say, right? Like we want to be able to grab these people and push them in the right way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not the wrong way, right?
Not the wrong way, absolutely.
But that is so different from working with a hardened ideologue committed to the alt-right. We should have like a shorthand for this, like ally recruitment versus like danger, like letting into the tent.
Yeah.
The nose of the camel
into the tent.
The nose of the camel. Because those are really different. And it's actually because I think like the camel is so dangerous that we need to do the other thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's a bit of a mixed metaphor.
But I understand. Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. We need to draw people to our side. I mean, and to my mind, that's one of the hallmarks of the left is that there is space. The left is the real big tent. You know, and I think we should have spaces for anybody who wants to go in the right direction. Now, if you're going in the right direction and you're just not comfortable around black people, okay, fine. As long as you're going in the right direction, do your thing.
Yeah.
We're trying to go in the right direction. We're trying to take the country in the right direction. Right.
Right.
So, and I think, we as in the left, we have to be better about how we tackle these things. You know, we're often, you know, this Schadenfreude thing about, you know, people losing their jobs in red states.
Exactly.
You know, to the degree the Schadenfreude is somewhat understandable, but as, you know, some of these folks are some of the best educated people in the country.
Right.
And you can't get beyond your personal bullshit. Vengeance. Yeah. It's like these, you know, to my mind, it reminds me of these vote shamers. Don't vote shame people. People vote. Oh, yeah, exactly. Voting, a vote is a personal choice. That's the purpose of a vote, right? So, right. But shaming somebody, but instead of going after the powerful people, the strong people who were in power who failed, you go after the little guy. And it's the same thing. You know, many of the people who voted for Trump may or may not be racist, but what they did vote for was a change in the status quo that was failing them. The same status quo that's failing us. But they took a different tack, right? Some of it may be race driven, some may be economic driven, some may be just driven by this shit ain't working, we need to do something, right? Desperation, right? Or some of it may be tribalism. I'm voting for a white guy, not as a racist thing, but I'm more familiar with, you know, he may be closer to what I want. And plus, there, you know, as we all know, there's a huge reservoir of hate for Hillary Clinton, right?
Right.
Whether some folks like to believe it or not, you know, one of the arguments was, well, you know, the right wing has been going at her for years. Yeah, then why are we still supporting her?
Or it's unfair the way they attack her. It's unfair. Yeah. It's misogynist. Like, yeah. Well, guess what? Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
And this actually speaks to what we're talking about, though, which is like, there's justice and morality and ethics, and then there's strategy, and then there's an overlap between them, right? Strategy, tactics. And so when you brought up the example of like a white person who maybe wouldn't want their daughter, I don't remember what you said, but they're not really that, they don't like black people, let's say.
Yeah, they're not comfortable around black people, like, we'll say, yeah.
So the question is, like, I guess starting at the most basic level, what we should be doing to reach everyone, I think, is like progressive policies and anti-racist, anti-homophobic messaging, especially as needed. Like, so you probably don't need the anti-racist messaging. Well, everyone, there's various forms, but, you know, you're going to maybe need to drive it home a little harder when you're talking to a white audience, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Class-based solidarity is the only path forward, right? Mm-hmm. Especially with more and more people falling out of the middle class, right? Because comfortable people don't make good allies in general. Right. But there's people are falling out of the middle class, you know, at an alarming rate. If we start off with class-based arguments, Medicare for all, free college and so on and so forth. If we start there, the other part is easier to my mind. Mm-hmm. Right. Nina Turner's really good for that, right? She'll say, okay, the economy's bad. It's worse for some people than others, right?
Yeah.
It's that, you know, the little subtle things, right? That you don't have to beat people over the head with it. And everybody in the country knows that black people got a raw deal, right? Anybody who's honest knows that black people had got a raw deal in this country. Right.
Right. So you're doing without saying, and I don't care about you if you're not.
Yeah. And I'm not, I'm going to, and a pox on all your houses. Exactly. If you don't believe that, you know, we should, you know, I should get 100 acres and 40 mules. Right. Right. So, you know, it's a little bit, to my mind, it's a baby step sort of thing. Right. There's going to be different, people are going to see things differently. Some people are going to be more radical than others. You know, but that's fine too. But we have to have a starting point, and I think it's economic policy. And when we're discussing economic policy, one of the things I'm going to do a piece on, I plan to do a piece on. I always say I'm going to do something, but I don't end up doing something else.
Yeah,
but
same here,
one of the things that I think we need to be tackling is wealth and income, not just $15 minimum wage. What about people that don't have any wealth? And aren't making any money, right? Because those are two different things, right? Because if I own my house because my grandparents gave it to me, right? I'm in a different, I may be working at McDonald's, but I'm not going to lose my house. Not for paying rent or not paying your mortgage, right? I own this house. Right. This is my house, right? Or if I have land that I've gotten from my family, right? This is not a big chunk of wealth, but it's more than what most Black people have, right? So mm-hmm. we can start having those conversations once those people are in those rooms, right? Let's have that conversation. Okay. We know we all want Medicare for all. We all want a $15 minimum wage. We all want free college. All these things are good for us and our children, right? And the future of the country. We want to do that.
And they don't hurt. And they're not throwing. I mean, because one of the narratives out there from the hate percent, as you and others have called people who are Bernie haters, basically,
absolutely.
Is that economic stuff is throwing people of color or women or LGBTQ people under the bus. And it's just the exact opposite, right?
Because all
of the things that you just mentioned are things that actually disproportionately help
people.
They help everyone.
Yeah, but disproportionately help people and Black people, right? Because there's a study done that the average Black woman with a college degree starts off their work life with an $11,000 negative wealth. And a lot of that is due, some of it is due to history, but a lot of that is due to college debt. So they're doing the right things, making the right decisions, playing the game as it's supposed to be played, right? But they're starting off in a worse position, right? Because they're playing the game the way it's supposed to be played.
Right.
So we as Black people, we need to understand that because of our wealth position, we don't have the same opportunities to pay for college. Even with Pell Grants were getting cut under Obama, never mind under Trump, right?
Right.
So even with Pell Grants, even with scholarships, athletic scholarships, or whatever type of slavery we're going to talk about today, with those things, Black people are less likely, they are more likely to have more debt when they come out of college, if they choose to go to college, right? Because we don't have that wealth to fall back on. My mother didn't have a house. My case is different, but someone can say their mother didn't have a house to put up as collateral to get that college loan, because that house was there, you got a lower interest rate. That way you're paying, $70,000 as opposed to $150,000. It's these little things that people don't realize happen to people that don't have the wealth to fall back on, any wealth to fall back on, negative wealth in most cases.
Right.
Yeah. So and these are the things that impact people of color more. It just simply does.
Right. I never know. I think I always joke about this on my show. Is it ignorance or dishonesty? Like, is someone saying that? Is it because they really, the most cynical thing is that they know that these things matter and are interrelated and are intersectional and that class and race intersect and everything. I think maybe sometimes it's just then the people who are cynical about it, they put out a lot of misleading PR. And of course you're going to find people who are good on class stuff and bad on race stuff, but you're also going to find the opposite.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think there's two things to my mind. I think part of what was at play here with this split between, because Black people have never, in our history, the whole civil rights movement was, the biggest people in our civil rights movement believed in the economic piece of this, right? Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, they have different ways of getting there.
Communists.
But, communists. Communists.
They try to smear civil rights as being communist, but between friends, we know communists did a lot of great stuff.
Absolutely. But the labor movement wouldn't have existed really without communists, right?
Yeah,
so all these good things were all these people during the civil rights movement, during the labor movement, all these great things that happened were because people understood that economics dictate, because money's power, right? The reason black communities are shit on is because we don't have any money to pay lawyers, right? we don't have any money.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have huge amounts of money or wealth to fight these things that are inflicted upon our community, right? And to my mind, if anybody who says that Black people will be better off without things like Medicare for All or free college, it's honestly, well, as you said, it's either dishonest or ignorant. I think it's a combination of the two. I think it's dishonest people spinning all this. This is all anti-Bernie stuff, right? There's never been a time in Black history where Black people did not understand that money in your pocket put you in a better position. No Black person in the history of my life has ever told me that you'll be better off with less money. Nobody, not a one, right? I think this is all targeted at Bernie because they knew Bernie was better on Hillary historically on two things, on race and on economics, right? So what you do is they swift-voted Bernie on race and economics. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what they did. They went at Bernie with this entirely dishonest campaign about fix race first and then fix economics. I'm like, hey, I'll fix the economics. I'll fix the race shit myself. They are interrelated, right? That was just a counter to the bullshit they were saying, right? They're completely interrelated.
Make buttons that say that.
Yeah. And that's something my mother says all the time. Just open the door. I get it myself, right?
That's one of those things that
really bothered me. That enraged me more than anything is that people were misleading Black people for Hillary Clinton, which in itself is a devastating, just the thought of that Black people are misleading Black people for a check and for Hillary Clinton. And that bothers me deeply because the history of the Clintons, in all honesty, the Clintons have really been no friend to Black people. And nobody who is serious about history or economics can say that they are. Not a single one. Right, because what Bill Clinton did during his time in office, the harms he did to us. Some people will tell you that decisions he made were based on the Republicans were really forceful about these things and they harmed the Black community.
Pressure.
Yeah, political pressure, which is bullshit. If you look back at the things he decided to do on his own, right, when he decided to make getting parole harder. Well, use DOJ decided to make getting parole harder. That was his decision, right? Killing Ricky Ray Rector back in Arkansas. That was his decision, right? These are all dog whistles to white folks to say, okay, I'm okay too. I'm one of you, right? I can, and historically, that's always been the key to power is turning your back on the Black community, right? That's just how it happens, right? And that's what
queens, all that language,
and this is what the Clintons did. They rolled that into somebody told me that they raised over $3 billion since they've been in politics. That's a lot of damn power, and some would still say, even when Obama was in office, they were still running the damn party. The Clintons have been running the Democratic Party forever, right? When the DLC blew into town and separated the party from labor concerns and race concerns, civil rights concerns, that's where the Democratic Party is now. They are a corporate party, right? And my belief is we need to take the party back from those corporate forces. Not an easy fight. I'm not saying it's an easy fight, but it's a fight that needs to happen.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I went off on a tangent there.
No, it's good. Keep going. No, it's great.
We did that politic, that Democratic autopsy, the autopsy for 2016. Me, Beth, and Matt Cox. We wrote a short book on that. That would be a great interview. I'll send you a PDF.
Then we got on the other side of the those are the things not to do, why we shouldn't work with certain people. And then you wrote on solidarity, class, race, and progress. What's interesting is you define, I really liked about this piece is that you define like the limits of collaborating or coalitions. You talk about norms and standards, right? So you say in the beginning of this, you say on solidarity, colon, class, race, and progress. Since the Democratic primaries of 2015-2016, the American left has been resurgent. Despite the rise of fascism across the West, the political left is offering policy alternatives that assure government works for all of us, not just a few. This vision is the preferred option of the vast majority of voters in the United States. The progressive platform Medicare for All, $15 minimum wage and free college, et cetera, is insanely popular. And then you say, though, that neither party is doing good people.
Yeah, absolutely not.
You know, you say that Dems are a little better. They pay mild lip service, but they're both beholden to wealthy, powerful special interests, is what you say, which is, of course, true. And then you talk about how we can get free, and that is through class and race solidarity. And you say that this is the type of unity that is feared most by the powers that be.
Back with Martin Luther King, absolutely.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's when everyone started, like even his usual allies had to stop.
Yeah. We can't mess with you. Yeah. Yeah, what most people, you know, it's a myth that all black people were behind Martin Luther King in any even before the Vietnam speech. Until Inc. got the paper for the Civil Rights Act, most people were like, hey, keep your head down, brother. What are you doing? You're going to get us killed, right? most of Black America was like that. A good chunk of Black America was like that, right? Mm-hmm. People always say, I was on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. No, you weren't. You went to work that day like everybody damn else. You know, you know, people were just trying to live their lives, right? And a lot of people thought that he wanted too much too fast, right? And a lot. I mean, of course, most white people believe that, but a lot of black people also believe that, and a lot of black people just wanted to trying to get by, right? Too busy with everyday things to be worrying about what Martin Luther King is turning his, as Eddie Griffin used to say, turn his shoes into sandals. You march all you want. I got to do. Right.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't understand that was a situation. And then, but as long as it's just black people get a few things here and there, it's not really dangerous to the powers that be. Right.
Yeah.
But when you start uniting these downtrodden people, that's dangerous. That's that coalition that they really, really fear. And really the only coalition they fear. Black folks. If we make too much noise, we'll burn our neighborhood down or whatever, and they'll contain it. they'll bring the National Guard and they'll bring in the police, National Guard and police. They'll contain it. We burned our neighborhood down. You know, we didn't own the shit, but we didn't own nothing. You know, but there's insurance. Everybody will be all right. Right. And now, the state of the way things are now, even if we do. They've, you know, those weaknesses that were there, that were exploited during the civil rights movement, the media, a relatively free media, pressure from outside of the country, from other countries, those things don't matter anymore. You know, the media, they run the media. Like, for instance, you know, the last uprising in Baltimore around Freddie Gray, right? That thing went on for days after the media stopped covering it, right? The powers that be used that to tamp down anything that could have happened, like what happened during the civil rights movement, right? And then the second thing is that external pressure when countries are telling you, hey, you guys look crazy out there, you know. Right. But now we're the biggest bear in the woods. We don't give a shit what anybody thinks. Oh, you don't like what we're doing? Give me my money back. We'll bomb your country. What are you gonna do? Or let somebody else bomb. We'll get an ally to bomb your country. We'll pull a coup. What you gonna do about it? Not a goddamn thing, right? So those two pain points don't exist anymore, right? So we have, and that makes it even more important to have a larger coalition, so it matters in the voting booth. They're closing that one off too, but that's where we need to be. We need a coalition that's gonna get in the voting booth. And that's why we need these numbers, right? And people want change. People want free college. People want to be able to be sick and not go into debt. You know, people need these things. And that's the coalition that's feared the most. And because it's feared the most because it's the most effective. Black folks are only 12% of the population. Oh, we talked about this before, right? As long as we're going at them in our particular silos, they'll do what they have.
Divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. They'll divide and conquer and go on about their business and nothing changes. But when we get a mass movement going, and I think that's what scared these folks most about Bernie, was, you know, he's filling stadiums and, right. you know, and Hillary can't even fill a damn gym. Mm-hmm. You know, I know I'm not saying that was always the case.
They always get mad when I say
stuff like that. But I know that wasn't always the case. But Bernie had no problem selling places out.
Yeah.
He was pulling
and
in.
And that was without the media being there.
And without the media being there. He was pulling more people than Obama did, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to admit that. Nobody wanted to say anything about that. And again, that's part of the, like you said, the media thing, the media blackout. And that's, I think that, right. that you know, I believe that was engineered by the DNC as well. But
you know, yeah, that famous thing where they're at showing Trump's empty podium.
Yeah, empty podium. Yeah, absolutely.
Right? While Bernie's actually speaking. Yeah, exactly.
Bernie's speaking. You know, he's in a stadium with, you know, 100,000 people, whatever it was. You know, he's right. filling these places up, standing room only, right? That scared the shit out of these folks. Yeah. and it should have. It should have, you know? And I think this class-based coalition is the only way we're going to get change. Absolutely the only way we're going to get change. Because that's what's going to change it in the voting booth. Excuse me, in the voting booth.
And you talk about how you have like limits of these coalitions and shared values. And you say these standards must... So solidarity calls for shared values and principles that guide us. All these standards must inform how we interact with one another. It should also establish left and right limits of our coalition. Many of us established a hard right limit by blocking white supremacists and white supremacy sympathizing Pepe aggressives. Their nebulous premise of fighting the deep state and mainstream media was not enough to even feign unity with racists. That's exactly what we were talking about. And then on the other end, the right end, the liberal end of the whatever.
Yeah, yeah, well, it's really right, but I called it left. Left and right, yeah.
Right. Exactly. Similarly, the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party represents the left limit. This neoliberal contingent is truly the first line of defense for corporate conservatism. They are so set on stopping progress, they're willing to actively undermine Bernie Sanders against Donald Trump in 2020 if their claims are to be believed. And you say we should always be open-minded and inclusive. That's the hallmark of leftist solidarity. However, inclusivity must be measured. We must codify the values, norms, and policy standards that allow individuals and groups into our coalition. It is on each of us to not let our burgeoning solidarity be undermined or sabotaged. We will allow for personal growth and change, but we have to watch the door carefully. Race proxy. You said black people are the only reason the Democratic Party is even remotely viable in American politics. Black women are the foundation that support. And because of the Dems' electoral dependence, the party worked extra hard to drive a wedge between the left and black women. Even though the progressive platform planks of Medicare for All, $15 minimum wage, and free college would disproportionately help black women live healthier and more fulfilled lives. The party could have quickly adopted the fiscally responsible and popular reforms. However, they chose to keep their donors happy. Their side has failed the black community over and over and over again. The party and its media lackeys continue to bait the left when it comes to black people. First, the Dems offered New Jersey Senator and Pharma Bro Cory Booker. Then you talk about Kamala Harris. Then you said we must be able to push back without fear or favor. The Clinton centrist wing of the Democratic Party, also known as the hate percent, would have you believe that anyone that does not support Senator Harris or Booker is a sexist racist. This is largely driven by the online bullies over at Centrist Rag Share Blue and Correct the Record, a Clinton-friendly and oligarch-funded troll farm. There are valid progressive arguments to be made against these people, even if you are black, especially if you are black. This is a harmful and shallow form of race solidarity. And, of course, we now know that Sally... Did you see this? Sally Albright apparently was being paid to run some troll farms.
Yeah, I saw that. But like you online, he sniffed her out using Buffer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Liking online picked her out. I'm trying to recruit him to write for ActiveR Press too.
And I feel a lot better that I wasted so much time on this stuff, given that she actually did have a farm.
Yeah, and several of those trolls were trolls, black women. Several of the trolls had pictures of black women.
So wait, is what's her name fake?
No, I don't think. I think she's a real person. I don't know if she. Yeah, she's a real piece of work.
Yeah.
Any, I'm sorry. I know. No, okay. I can't stand her because it's not a personal thing. Well, I guess it's personal now, but it's not. You are in the way of progress for my family. That's who you are. Whether you're black, brown, purple, pink, or blue. You are come between my grandkids and free college and Medicare for all, right?
Yeah,
that's who you are. If you're in the way, you are my class enemy. And if we need all of us on the left need to start thinking like that, in my opinion. I'm not going to tell people how to think, obviously, but that's sure. my view, right? Because if we're constantly caught up in these other, I got to stick with this person because they're black, even though they're going the wrong way. I got to stick with this person because he's white. This guy's in my neighborhood, or this guy's a fellow cop, whatever that is, right? As long as we keep falling for these phony arguments, right? They're going to keep throwing these red herrings at us, right? There's no reason in the world to float Cory Booker to be freaking president. He is nowhere near popular enough to be president of the United States. You floated him. He was a trial balloon to make the left go out, lose their minds. He was fresh off voting against the reimportation bill, reimportation amendment that Bernie was pushing, right? He was fresh off of voting against that. And you're going to float him as a presidential, when we're talking about Medicare for All, and then you're going to float him as a presidential candidate? No. They're not serious about Cory Booker being president, nor are they serious about Kamala Harris being president. Regardless of who Kamala Harris is, she's not ready to be president. And she has way too much baggage in the law and order arena. If you do your research, right? She's got way too much baggage, especially for the black community. I wish somebody would bring on a black activist from San Francisco. A real black activist. Don't bring and his blue out there to do who say whatever you tell him to say. Bring a real black activist from San Francisco on the ground and talk to him or her how they feel about Kamala Harris. You'll hear a whole different story about Kamala Harris than the Democrats are trying to tell.
Yeah, but look, they were able to get the media and the Clintons were able to get away with it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's another reason why they're trying to limit our ability to organize online with the net neutrality from the right and the corporate centrist wing of the Democratic Party pushing Facebook to limit us and Twitter limiting us, you know, all this stuff and YouTube limiting us, right? That's driven by the centrists. That's not driven by the right. That's driven by the centrists, right? Mark Zuckerberg doesn't give a shit what Republicans think. He doesn't. But you know, he's part of the professional class that the Democrats purport to support, right? Mm-hmm. And the well educated, you know, skilled worker class, right? You know, the whole 15% of the country. In any event, those are the people that are helping limit our ability to communicate because they like their money, right? And just like I said before, our left, quote unquote, leftist millionaires, they're full of shit. They really are full of shit. If they were real about what they're, you know, patriotic millionaires or whatever, if they were for real about what they're talking about, there's no reason why there's not a leftist network that competes with MSNBC. Mm-hmm. You know, there's enough people for it to get advertising dollars. There's no question about that. There's enough talent. No question about that.
Right.
But the problem is want to and willing to invest in, right? The Young Turks proved that it's a viable strategy, right? They proved that over and over again, right? But
yeah, we got to start our own.
That's
the thing that
it's just numbers.
The river runs through it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just simply numbers, and that's math. That's one thing. Yeah. That's why I hate math. You can't mess with math. It's right or it's wrong. You know, that's why I like words. You can bend them to your will. Right? Math, it is what it is. And this is a math issue. We need more bodies in the polls. That's the only way to affect change. Primary folks and get people to vote. Those are the only things that affect change in this country. It is what it is. You know, and I don't, you know, of course the media is involved in that as well. But for grassroots folks, that's our only path. Primarying folks and getting people to the polls. Shoe leather activism. That's the only thing that folks with no money have for
you
right
can
now.
Run for office.
Me? No. Too many skeletons in that closet. Pass. Hard pass.
Next episode, you can talk about skeletons.
Yeah, the skeleton episode.
Well, thank you so much.
That was Michael Graham. And to hear the rest of my interview with him, including some fun behind-the-scenes moments, please go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And now we speak to Natalie Shore about a piece that she wrote for Jacobin called The Feminist Case for Single Payer. Natalie Shore is a writer and journalist whose work can be found at The Atlantic, Slate, BuzzFeed, Pacific Standard, Daily Beast, LA Times, Salon, and Jacobin. She's also with the DSA of Los Angeles, the Democratic Socialists of America. Natalie writes in her piece on The Feminist Case for Single Payer, "Some mainstream feminists knock single payer as a distraction from the fight to defend the Affordable Care Act. But while the Affordable Care Act undeniably improved some women's lives, it could not dismantle gendered barriers to care. Of all systems, single payer is capable of going furthest to eliminate them. By removing power over healthcare from employers and spouses and replacing unequal tiers with one unified insurance pool, we could fund our healthcare system with progressive taxes. That way, we could guarantee everyone the care they need and make it free at the point of service. Ability to pay, pre-existing conditions, employment status, and gender would cease to be barriers. Building Medicare for all with robust guarantees for tougher to access services like abortion and gender-affirming care would force American society as a whole to address the care disparities women face." Here's my discussion with Natalie Shore about a piece that she wrote for Jacobin called The Feminist Case for Single Payer.
What made you write that article?
Well, I think that in general, people don't necessarily think about all of the other social implications of a policy like this and how it can improve the lives of a lot of people that we would consider marginalized in our society. And the truth is that robust social democratic entitlement programs are particularly good for women. When we have a program, we have an entire welfare structure in the United States that's largely privatized and accessed through employment, that's really difficult for women because we don't have an accompanying program that provides child care, elder care, that provides, maternity leave, maternity care. And so that means that women disproportionately seek out freelance employment, part-time employment, and these often don't confer the sort of benefits that we would associate with a welfare state. They're also often insured by their spouses or fathers as dependents, which makes a situation so that they have less control in those relationships than they should. And that all of these things in combination are really punitive for women. And sure enough, the World Economic Forum each year puts together a list of the best countries for gender inequality. And the top three right now are Iceland, Norway, and Finland, all of which have publicly run healthcare programs, National Health Service, and one, I believe, in which there's a single government payer. So, there's data that bears this out, and it's pretty clear that, programs that socialize a lot of the care roles that disproportionately fall to women and doesn't commodify their healthcare, which on average they use more than men, that this helps women have more agency in their lives overall.
So you're saying that single payer is not just a white male privilege fantasy?
Yeah, no. We're not just advocating this to seem cool and catch boys.
Right. Yeah, I've talked about this a lot, but this idea that, that anyone's saying this is going to get rid of sexism, get rid of racism. But the truth is these things do help with those issues. As you demonstrate in this piece on gender.
Yeah, of course, and no one would argue that, universal healthcare will end sexism or racism.
Right.
It doesn't change everything overnight, and there are still plenty of other issues that affect people's lives outside of that. But it does help ameliorate some of the harms that are leveraged against marginalized people because of racism and sexism. Largely because of sexism. I think that you could make a pretty clear case for the fact that care roles are so privatized and that we don't socialize them. I think that that's, an inherently sexist thing. And so, right. If you're an American, then sexism isn't just people having a bad attitude about you because you're a woman and that they need to educate themselves and think about it. It's also because institutional power acts in such a way that it affects my life and, materially affects my life, and that there are actual outcomes associated with that that aren't just about, feelings or how many memes you read that make you woker. You know, I mean, I think that states that socialize at least some domestic duties that fall disproportionately to women, states that are able to produce legislation that allows or that forbids my body from being more commodified than a man's. You know, I mean, women use more healthcare on average, particularly when they're not ill. You know, people talk about the sick being the ones who use healthcare. I mean, of course, that's not always the case. It's also the pregnant or the, you know, uterus havers right. who are, you know, disproportionately women. Mm. And, you know, when you have healthcare that isn't free from the point of service, you're going to be shifting costs onto people who use it more, who are more often women. We also live a lot longer than men on average. And those years are when healthcare is the most expensive. And those people probably have access to Medicare, but they're still going to face a lot of cost burdens. And so all of these things are issues that affect women pretty profoundly. And in Denmark, mothers' wages are about 40% of men's overall, I believe. And, you know, in the United States, it's around 27, 28%. Mm. These things make a huge difference.
Yeah. I mean, just think about mammograms, pap smears, all these things that are life-saving.
Yeah. I mean, we just have a lot going on, you know? I mean, we've got to get in there for maintenance a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. And like not only, so it's not only the healthcare issue, which is obviously a lot of it. We also have no maternity leave. We have no, for the most part, no public child care.
Mm-hmm.
You have this situation wherein women make less. And, you know, when these things are privatized, they have to presumably, you know, if they want to work at a job that does confer health benefits, that means that they have to pay for childcare, which comes out of an already lower salary on average.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to take a more flexible job or cut back on hours so that they don't have to pay for childcare so that they can be with their kids more, oops, whoops, then you don't get health coverage. And, you know, if you happen to have a low enough income to qualify for Medicaid, you know, that's an awfully low income. You know, I mean, it's 130% of the federal poverty line, which certainly doesn't encapsulate all people who are poor or struggling. You know, maybe you have access to Medicaid if you're in a state that expanded it, or, you know, if you're on the Obamacare exchanges, those plans tend to be expensive, cost less, have massive deductibles. So however you slice it, women are disproportionately suffering in a system that basically has no welfare state, or at least no public welfare state. Our welfare state is largely conferred by private employment.
Right. So yeah, the irony is that if you care about sexism, inequality, this is not a distraction. This is part of a way that you deal with that. And again, it's a very dishonest, weird idea that because something doesn't 100% get rid of something, it's not worth pursuing. I mean, no policies ever 100% get rid of things, but the people who are kind of dismissing single payer would not dismiss Lilly Ledbetter.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really important. And I think in general, you know, to whatever degree social democracy is associated with Bernie Sanders in our current American context, or, you know, Medicare for All is certainly associated with Sanders. I think that a lot of the people, you know, especially on Twitter, who are outspoken about it, a lot of the people who are against those things tended to be very pro-Hillary Clinton for largely feminist reasons. You know, these are people that think about gender issues a lot and are passionate about them. And I think, you know, in most cases, that's in good faith, even though I have political disagreements with these people. I think that there was not sufficient consideration about what feminism means when it comes to healthcare, not enough discussion about, you know, what social democracy means for women's lives versus, you know, scant means testing and, you know, a few extra tax credits. Those are completely different. And if you want women to have full lives, if you want them to have as much agency over their lives as possible, you have to support something like this. I don't think that there's an alternative.
Right. And of course, I mean, I think a big issue with the Hillary feminism stuff is that there was a real kind of identification with a personal journey and narrative for many people. And I think less of a kind of focus on the universal effects of policy.
You know, yeah.
I think a lot of people really cared about what happened to Hillary Clinton as an individual and saw themselves in her. And yeah, it's an interesting thing that happened.
Yeah, I mean, I am sympathetic to that. Like, I think that Hillary Clinton became this sort of cultural vessel for people's very real experiences of sexism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are absolutely, you know, I have serious qualms with Hillary Clinton, but of course there are these vile misogynistic attacks on her from the right constantly. You know, like
of course.
I absolutely understand being defensive of this person
right
in that context. And you know, I understand why it was very deeply important to people to have a woman in office. I get all of those things, and I don't think that they're worth nothing. But
right.
The idea that, you know, feminism extends throughout her political project is demonstrably untrue.
Right. And I mean, we don't, again, without comparing her politics totally to Margaret Thatcher, people get that through Margaret Thatcher, you know, with that example. People get it with Sarah Palin, and not comparing her to Sarah Palin at all. She's like much better on women's issues than Sarah Palin is. But
sure.
Just as an example of identity, and I'm not dismissing identity politics, good identity politics, not shallow, exploitive ones. Just the idea of policy versus identity. And yeah, I think it's totally true. And I've said this a lot. Like, we, of course, Hillary faces and face sexism. There's no doubt. And not just the misogynistic, openly, often like degrading, demeaning, vilifying, demonizing, but like literally demonizing, like making her into a demon or a goblin, as
yeah.
Alex Jones told me when I interviewed him. I just ran into him at the RNC in Cleveland, but more subtle forms of it. And I don't deny that at all. But again, that doesn't mean that I'm going to I can acknowledge that and empathize, and also think that someone running against her has better policies in general and for women.
Yes.
What got you interested in writing about this stuff, by the way?
So years ago, I wrote my master's thesis on global health, specifically drug-resistant tuberculosis in the former Soviet Union. And so I wrote about that for a few years, and then got really into, different national healthcare systems. And I think really just within the past 2 years, I've gotten politically focused on it as a major issue.
Oh, cool. What was your master's in? Was it public health or?
Journalism and Russian studies.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
Did not know that. Awesome. Well, thank you again so much, Natalie, for coming on the show. What should people look out for?
I have a print piece in the next issue of Jacobin.
Nice. That's a healthcare issue, right? The Jacobin next issue?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much, Katie. It was fun.
That was Natalie Short. You can also find more work by Natalie in Jacobin's most recent issue, which is on healthcare. And you can find out more about her at natalieshore.com. That's NatalieSHure.com. Or follow her on Twitter at Natalie Shorley. NatalieSHurely. Again, that's NatalieSHurely. You can find Michael at ProgressiveArmy.com, ActifyPress.com, and Actify.press. And to hear the rest of my interview with him, including some fun behind-the-scenes moments, please go to Patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's Patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Or on Twitter, BlupFront1. That's BlupFront1, number one. BlupFront1, and you just put in the number one. You don't write it out. God, these Twitter handles are hard. Speaking of which, I'm KT Halps. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. My co-host Gabe Pacheco is Gabe_Pacheco, and you can use the hashtag KT Halps Show. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S-H-O-W. But you can hear the KT Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI, that's 99.5 FM, or WBAI.org. You can also find us on SoundCloud and iTunes, where you can rate and review us, and I sure hope you do. Thanks so much for listening to the Katie Halper Show. See you next week.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.